Leonard Cohen tells it this way. The door had opened slowly. My father, he came in. I was 9 years old, and he stood so tall above me. His blue eyes, they were shining, and his voice was very cold. He said, I've had a vision, and you know I'm strong and holy. I must do what I've been told. So he started up the mountain. I was running, he was walking, and his axe was made of gold. Well, the trees, they got much smaller. The lake, a lady's mirror. We stopped to drink some wine. Then he threw the bottle over, broke a minute later, and he put his hand on mine. I thought I saw an eagle, but it might have been a vulture. I never could decide. Then my father built an altar. He looked once behind his shoulder. He knew I would not hide. Tell us a story, Dad. Tell us a story before we go to bed. Okay, son, I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you the story of our father Abraham. Gather close to the fire now. It was like this. And the Hebrew parent would tell his wide-eyed son one of the greatest of Israel's stories. He would say how the wind howled and moaned on Mount Moriah, a cold and lonely place. He would recount how Isaac was laid on the hastily constructed stone altar, bound and ready. How Abram gripped the knife tight in his sweating hand and raised it for the kill, ready to plunge it into the heart of the son he loved. Down it came, down, down, stop. And the wide-eyed child of the desert would start, as he always did, when his father told him that awesome and terrible tale. And now it's bed for you, my lad, but remember the faith of our father Abraham, and remember that our God, not like the gods of Canaan, said stop. Our God had no interest in the disgusting practice of human sacrifice, never has, never will. A powerful, dreadful and unforgettable story. Sweet dreams, little fella. The champion of atheism, Richard Dawkins, hates this story. For him, it sums up much that is bad about religion and religious people. He talks disparagingly about God's last-minute change of plan. It turns out, he suggests, that God was only joking after all. Dawkins goes on, by the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example simultaneously of child abuse, bullying in an asymmetrical power relationship, and a first use of the Nuremberg defence. I was only obeying orders. For us too, maybe even more so, it's a strange and difficult story with its grim echoes of superstition and child sacrifice. And it seems it's God who starts the whole drama moving with his grotesque request. You can almost hear the agonized reverberations of Abram's soul-wrenching cry of, no, no, no. When first the impossible possibility, the revolting requirement is presented to him to sacrifice his son on a lonely mountaintop. We know how much he had longed for the birth of his son. Uninhibited was his devotion to the boy's welfare. Yet it was almost as if God is rubbing it in, ratcheting up the crescendo of anguish. Take your son, your only son, whom you love. In modern times, we've had more than our fair share of child killers who heard voices in their heads and believed for long enough for them to do the terrible deed, that this was something God was asking them to do. So it takes us more than a little by surprise that this strange and disturbing, and for Isaac, you'd have to think, emotionally scarring event should be presented as a high example of faith. We know they lived in different times, but come on. Bizarre or what? Grotesque or what? People do have the strangest ideas about God and do the oddest things in order to please him, or so they imagine. They will cut themselves with stones, starve themselves. They will live on top of poles for months like a devout David Blaine. They will travel across continents to visit a holy place, or die with their husbands on funeral pyres in order to please God. They will walk on their knees to Fatima, refuse to buy a Sunday paper on the Isle of Skye in order to please God. They will deny themselves a bacon sandwich, or they will plot to murder in hundreds those who do not believe, thinking this will somehow bring delight to the heart of God. No wonder Dawkins shakes his head and wonders about faith and God and believers. The fifth and final Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, came out last week to mixed reviews. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom is easily the darkest entry of the series, and if there's one moment viewers will remember, it's the human sacrifice scene. In this sequence, the aptly named sacrifice victim has his heart ripped out before being lowered in a pit of lava and burned alive. A great movie for all the kids. So many ancient religious expressions embraced the practice. The Carthaginians, the Chinese, the Aztecs, the Celts, the Egyptians, the Incas, and the Canaanites, and others. So the fact that Abraham himself did not find it impossibly odd that God should insist he sacrifice his only son gives us a clue as to the culture in which he lived, a world in which such a request did not seem so strange. All the local gods of the indigenous population of Canaan, where Abram had settled, seemed to require human sacrifice as a measure of devotion, as a means of cooling their gods' anger, a way to propitiate their rage. And if it disappointed and perplexed Abram somewhat to discover that, in this respect, his God, it seems, was just like all the rest, he isn't fazed by the fact. For this was the world Abram inhabited. This was the way people spoke, how they conducted their religious life. God addresses Abraham's life in the context, within the cultural framework of his own situation in life, and invites him to discover something profound, something new and significant about the divine thinking within the terms of his familiar world, the ancient world of the primitive tribes of the ancient Near East. This is how God will be understood and where he will be discovered. He shows himself where we are. And it's using that vocabulary of ideas, all the superstitions, prejudices and limitations, it's in there that God will make his very different and distinctive claims on the life of Abraham. In much the same way as he's able to address our lives through the thought forms, ideas and worldview that obtain today, now. And we really ought to be suspicious of any form of theology or liturgy, and they are still around, ways of thinking about God and talking about God that are not actually contemporary, relevant to our lives, our needs, our longings, our full-blooded 21st century understanding of how things are. If we allow how we talk about God and how we talk about God to remain conveniently steeped in the language and culture of previous generations, locked into the preconceptions and prejudices of other times, if that happens, and we're content to let that happen, we risk losing immediacy. We might lose the meaning for us, for our life, our times. There are ways of being the church and living the faith and thinking about the faith that remain sort of frozen in a time warp. And when we let that happen, we run the risk of the church addressing issues that maybe were issues 100 years ago, but are not very high on anyone's league table of needs here and now. The essential truths about God remain constant. The means of expression we use to communicate those truths must adapt to the realities of the times, or no one will know what we're talking about, or worse, no one will care. And that goes for when we talk about the role of women, about relationships, about sexuality, about justice, about crime and punishment. That reality is unsettling, uncomfortable and demanding, but it is reality. We cannot and should not take refuge in archaic preoccupations. Ways of expressing the faith that simply sound odd and inaccessible to our contemporaries. Otherwise, what we say, because of how we say it, will lead to our being relegated to the dustbin of irrelevance. Meanwhile, back at Mount Moriah, we need to ask what we learn about the nature of faith from this strange event within Abraham's story. Well, we learn that there are certainly, inevitably, questions hanging in the air when we embark on the life of faith. For 3 long days, Abram had a million questions buzzing around his brain as he's dragged his reluctant feet up the mountain. What good would it do anyone if Isaac, the child of promise, were to be killed? What would people say when they learned of the events that were soon to take place in the desolation of the desert? What would the verdict of history be? How would time judge this craziness? And how would he tell Sarah, the boy's mother? How could he tell Sarah that he had felt compelled to do this thing to her precious boy? And above all the other questions, writ large in his soul, the question, why? Why this? Why me? We might ask why indeed, for at first glance it looks like a kind of divine cruelty, for if God knows everything, he would surely know that when the chips were down, Abram would obey, so why make him go through the agony? Was it perhaps the only way God could bring Abram himself once and for all, and with an unforgettable clarity, to the realisation that this God, this his God, wanted nothing to do with any expression of religion that included in its thinking the notion of human sacrifice or anything like it, anything that degrades or diminishes, hurts or harms, damages or downgrades the worth of people, the importance of real people? And to show them that what we do in the realm of faith affects people, it helps them or it hinders them. So that far from being the same as the sick divinities of Canaan, Abram's God is revealed to be distinctive and rigorous in his rejection of the vile cruelties associated with the Canaanite fertility cults and their bloody rituals. One of the shabbiest examples of sloppy thinking in our times is that simplistic, convenient and fundamentally wrong notion that the religions of the world are all basically saying the same thing. If only that were so, life would be a lot simpler. And sure, on a superficial first glance, each of the great faiths may have a sort of similarity, a sense of the importance of some kind of worship, a special place to do the worshipping in, an ethic that accompanies the spiritual teaching, a sense of the otherness of the divine being or force, a view on the eternal outcome of things. But these apparent superficialities should not blind us to the crucial differences that give each of the great faiths their character and separate them off from one another. The faith of Abraham, with its desire to demonstrate devotion to the divine being, offers a radically different interpretation of reality from that of the Canaanite worldview. This is new. This is different. This is a breakthrough and a key distinguishing mark of that difference. The issue of human sacrifice, the understanding of the nature of God that underpinned the rejection of that practice. So here's the vital difference. This is what is at stake. This is the light that breaks through the darkness of Mount Moriah. If God were to be feared and kept at bay by wilder and wilder sacrifices, then that's one view. But if God is to be loved and is loving in his commitment to us, then these excesses have no place in how religion is done. Two very different understandings. Very different. Perhaps the whole incident was about Abraham finding out for himself the extent of his loyalty, the relative strength or weakness of his faith. Only when he has been to the brink with God, only then will he know for himself what he believes and with what passion he believes it. Poised over the prone body of his son, the questions burn in his brain. That's the way it is with faith. Then, as now, now, as then. Real, strong, wakeful, alert faith. There are questions, especially when life hits you like a steamrolled roller and your assurances and your certainties are all crushed to a pulp. Because faith is a living, real, moving thing, things are not done and dusted. If it's neatly tied little parcels we want, we should try something other than the life of faith. For the believer, and you hardly need me say this, for the believer, there is no immunity from the bumps and scrapes and kicks in the teeth that just being a person involves. And therefore, the man or woman of faith can have no certainty of certainty. They only have one certainty: God and his love. And that's the basic recourse, the spiritual food that sustains the believer in all their explorings, questings and searchings in the comparative dark for meaning. Just coping with living presents us with a giant question mark. And as we cling to the solid rock of God, as we wrestle with the mysteries, like Abraham, we know this much: that we worship a God we cannot see. Listen for a God whose voice we don't hear, other than in the confusion of our own soul, in the quietness of our waiting spirit. We shake our heads. Wouldn't it be so much easier, Lord, if you made yourself plainer, revealed yourself more convincingly, made this life of faith a little less perplexing, less difficult? Lord, why is it so hard, like rolling a boulder up a mountain? And as Abraham got no reply, we get no answer. But we find things out along the way. I mentioned before the minister in the city of Edinburgh who every morning climbed the hill called Arthur's Seat, looked out over the city and prayed for his congregation. Well, as the months passed, the congregation stayed pretty much the same. But the minister ended up with thighs like tree trunks. The vital clue we have is this: once having climbed Mount Moriah, having obeyed and followed and trusted to the utmost, Abraham, out of the questioning, found to his surprise that he had grown strong, had come to this clear and utter conviction that the Lord himself will provide. That while there will always be questions, as long as there are believers to ask them, there was also the Lord who would enable, who would provide. Faith coming through the dark night of the soul emerges bruised and bloodied, but stronger, as a byproduct of the pressures the muscles develop, strong and ready to move forward, trusting still. Abram and Isaac. Leonard Cohen tells this great story in a song. The door it opened slowly. My father, he came in. I was 9 years old. And he stood so tall above me. His blue eyes, they were shining, and his voice was very cold. He said, I've had a vision, and you know I'm strong and holy, I must do what I've been told. So he started up the mountain. I was running, he was walking, and his axe was made of gold. Well, the trees, they got much smaller, the lake, a lady's mirror. We stopped to drink some wine. Then he threw the bottle over, broke a minute later, and he put his hand on mine. I thought I saw an eagle, but it might have been a vulture. I never could decide. Then my father built an altar. He looked once behind his shoulder. He knew I would not hide. You who build these altars now to sacrifice these children, you must not do it any more. A scheme is not a vision, and you have never been tempted by a demon or a god. You who stand above them now, your hatchets blunt and bloody, you were not there before. When I lay upon a mountain, and my father's hand was trembling with the beauty of the word.